Morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
First thing I'd like to do is apologize for my tardiness.
Well, we made you come over here, so you can proceed.
This case...
How much do you want to reserve for rebuttal?
None.
All right.
This case involves a young man who was convicted at trial of two counts of a violation of court order, five counts of cyber-stalking, one count of harassment, threat to kill, and one count of telephone harassment. And we have put forward three particular areas that we believe were issues that this court should consider. First being that during the trial, the defendant testified. There is nothing in the record indicating that the court did anything to assure that the defendant, Mr. Park, was aware of his rights to not testify or remain silent.
Isn't there a concern if that was the rule that, you know, what if counsel had advised Mr. Park not to testify? And we don't know because that's not the record. And then all of a sudden the trial judge says, and you know, you have the right to testify. And then isn't that sort of putting the lawyer between the client and the court and interfering with that attorney-client relationship?
Well, as we indicate in the brief, the court is involved in 3.5 hearings. The court is involved in statements of defendant on plea of guilty, making sure that the defendant has been advised of his rights, has been advised of his right to remain silent. In a 3.5 hearing, he's advised that not only is there a right to testify, but that testimony will not be used during the trial unless he testifies at trial. All those things are done by the court in pretrial hearings or in plea of guilty to make sure that the defendant is aware personally of his right to remain silent or his right to testify or not testify.
That's interesting. On the 3.5, isn't that a court rule requirement? That's
yes.
A constitutional requirement.
Yes.
But you're saying this is would be a constitutional requirement?
That's our position, is that, you know, my position and our position is that it's a better way of addressing the issue than remaining silent on it. When you look at the two.
Would you be satisfied if at the beginning of each criminal trial the defendant was given a piece of paper that listed all of his constitutional rights and was asked to sign it, and with a form indicating that by signing it, he indicated he had read it?
Well, it would address to some degree not only the right to testify, but all the other rights.
Well, I'm something more than
right.
Just this right, but
right.
The very.
And I'm more focused on his right to testify.
Well, let me tell you, a concern I have is counsel and the client have talked about this. They disagree about it. And just before the defendant gets up in front of the jury, the judge says, excuse me, members of the jury, I have a matter I need to take up outside your presence. The bailiff gets the jurors up. They march out. The defendant standing there, and the judge says, Mr. Defendant, are you sure you want to testify? You know you don't have to. Isn't that going to chill the decision the defendant has just made?
Well, a court can put it that way. A judge can say.
Well, I may be wrong. Tell me.
No. A judge can say, put it a different way, say, and ask the attorney, has Mr. Park been advised by you of his right to remain silent or testify?
So could we, are you then, if we adopted a rule of constitutional magnitude that before calling his client as a witness, defense counsel had to file a written certification with the court that he discussed the Fifth Amendment, including the right not to testify, with the defendant? Would that do it?
I think so. I think that would be the better practice. And I've done many, many, many jury trials, and I've had judges do both. And my preference as a trial attorney is once the prosecution is arrested, I've always asked the judge, can we have a short recess so that the jury doesn't realize that it's tied to the defendant may either not testify or testify. And I've asked the court, or put on the record, that I've advised my client of his right to testify, and I've advised him there's two things he can control in a trial, which are is whether he testifies, whether he pleads guilty. And I tell the court he's decided to testify or he's decided not to testify. And then the judge has the ability to say, is that correct, Mr. Park, if it's Mr. Park, whoever. And that takes care of that issue.
What if the defendant were then to blurt out, well, you know, I really wanted to testify, but my lawyer's saying if I testify, we're going to get into this other incident, which nobody knows about, and all of a sudden you got all these confidential communications on the record. I mean, it may happen, it may not. It seems like a huge risk.
That is the risk. There's no question about it. And that's a risk that a court runs, for example, in not only a 3.5 issue, but in a statement of defendant and plea of guilty. And courts hear it all the time when clients plead guilty. Well, judge, I really didn't do this, but I'm taking the advice of my attorney, take the deal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that's a common occurrence in court. So
I'd like to move, time's, the clock's running out, so I'd like to move to the sentencing issue.
And okay.
I'm trying to understand. You know, there's a standard for ineffective assistance of counsel. It doesn't seem to be specific to any phase of trial or representation. You either do, you either violate the whatever the appropriate, and then you prejudice the client. Is there any case outside of a death penalty case that says what's an obligation for a defense counsel in a sentencing?
No, there's not. And as the court's aware, there are a number of recent death penalty cases that address that particular issue. And a number of death penalties that have been overturned and sent back for resentencing because trial counsel did not do a sufficient investigation of mitigating factors. The problem I think the court would have is where is there the cutoff from death penalty to the theft case, for example. And in this case, as the court can see, obviously it was a very serious situation. He ended up with 300 months. And in our opinion, my opinion, the defense attorney should have done something to present to the court at sentencing, because it's obvious from reading the record that what the prosecution's position was, they filed a sentencing memorandum and what their position was regarding sentencing, which was they were going to recommend 300 months. And the defense attorney did not respond to that.
How would we ascertain whether any prejudice arose from the failure to provide anything at the time of sentencing other than perhaps an oral presentation? I mean, how can we say that the judge would have imposed some lesser sentence? I mean, if for example, in this case, we had a psychological evaluation that had been done, and you could say, well, if the judge had looked at this, then maybe it would have made a difference.
I think the only way you can do that is to look at it as a judge, and you've all been trial court judges, and say, this doesn't seem right, doesn't seem fair to me.
So you're advocating a smell test?
Well, basically, yes. I think judges can still do that. Whether it's an appellate judge or a trial judge, say, you know, this doesn't seem right to me. When you have, and that's why you have to look at the record, and you have to look at the reasons that this trial court judge addressed in terms of the sentence that was imposed.
Would it be appropriate for us to remand this to the trial court to have defense counsel explain why he didn't? I mean, perhaps his answer is, here are the things I knew about that I didn't want to have to tell the trial court about. It was better to keep quiet than to, by omitting them in my description, breach my ethical duties or including in my description and prejudicing my client.
Well, that would be a reference hearing that would definitely be a beneficial to this court and to the trial court. There's no question in my mind.
Well, what would, that would have to happen because since it's ineffective assistance of counsel, there'd have to be new counsel either retained or appointed.
Right.
It would be waived. The privilege would be waived as to the former counsel, so the state could call that attorney as easily as the defense could.
Well, then that gets me to my last question, and that is, since this requires information that's not in the record, why isn't that more appropriately addressed in a PRP than a direct appeal?
Well, that's usually where it is addressed. I agree. The problem, I can tell you the problem with that is Mr. Park is entitled to a court-appointed attorney on appeal. He's not on PRP.
So. Thank you. That exhausts your time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kelly Penders for the State of Washington. I'm going to focus on the two issues that the court seems to be interested in today, which was whether or not Mr. Park's right to constitutional right to remain silent was violated when he testified. And it's the state's position, clearly, that it was not. Case law is clear that the trial court is not required to inform a defendant of a constitutional right to testify at trial. And the reasoning behind that is something that's been raised here today by the court. There's a concern that that inquiry could invade the province of the discussion that a defendant and his trial counsel may have had about testifying. They may be waiting to decide. There may be other factors. There may be advice that was given as to whether or not they should testify. And it's and the position of the courts have been it is an intrusion into that to that trial strategy for the court to make that inquiry.
It's an interesting point in this case because not only did we have the 3-5 issue, we had the stipulation to the admissibility. So there was extensive colloquy done on both of those. Just a little bit more, and they could have covered this other issue as well.
And in fact, I think because there was extensive colloquy on that, I think that issue was certainly covered with that stipulation. 8 days before the defendant decided to testify, there was this colloquy about the 3-5 waiver and that he was agreeing that these statements come in. And so certainly that's a reminder of his rights. It's not a long distance. In its briefing, there was a discussion that it's, an interrogation, for example. An individual is interrogated, and 3 weeks, a month later, the officer comes back to ask him some more questions. We don't have that time period here. We have a very short time period in which there was a discussion about the rights that a defendant would have and the rights that he may be giving up.
So is there a situation you can envision where there's enough time that the defendant would need to be affirmatively advised of his right not to testify at trial? I mean, you're focusing on a time rather than anything else right now.
I think that when you look at the circumstances of this particular case, I think that adds to the fact that we can assume that the defendant made a knowing waiver of his right to remain silent when he took the stand. The case law has said that the court may assume that there's a knowing waiver of the right when a defendant decides to take the stand.
My question gets at is, do we always assume that, or do we only assume that if he was told that sometime within the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks, month?
I don't think that there's a time limit on it, Your Honor.
Does he have to have been told sometime?
The assumption is that he was when you're looking at the record.
Does the record have to reflect that at some time he was told?
It's the state's position that it was not, because then I think we're getting into tricky area. Then I think we're getting into potentially the defendant giving out privileged communications between him and his attorney. We're getting into
there
potentially.
There were ways suggested, though, that you wouldn't necessarily do that. I mean, for example, having counsel just state on the record, I've advised my client, and that would be the end of it.
It could, but you do run into a situation where you have defendants who may blurt out despite that they have things that they like to do.
Well, and as pointed out, that happens all the time anyway.
It does. It does indeed.
Well, and to follow up on some of the questions I had for appellant's counsel, I mean, it, in some ways, if it had been a difficult relationship between the defendant and the attorney anyway, it would invite almost an increase in the conflict because then you would have counsel and the defendant disagreeing in court, admittedly out of the presence of the jury, but saying, well, I told him not to testify, and he wants to testify, and then it just seems to me it would degenerate from there, or maybe not, but it seems a risk that he would have.
Right, and that's why I think we don't do it.
On the sentencing issue,
yes,
should the defense counsel have done something? Not even a pre-sentence report, not a letter from the family. you know, just admittedly an argument sort of for treatment. I'm not even sure he was eligible for treatment on these offenses, and that's not brief, but it just didn't seem like a lot.
I think defense counsel knew that she was facing an uphill battle here. She had an individual who had testified at trial and taken no responsibility for what he had done. He blamed the victims, all of the victims of his different crimes, and was clearly not taking any sort of responsibility.
Did you give up because it's a steep hill?
I don't think you give up, but you take into consideration what you can and cannot present before the court. We had an individual, this individual had been convicted of similar crimes before, and it's tough when you've got that and you've still got this individual denying what he did was wrong.
Yeah, but Judge Leach's point is correct. The whole thing was tough. The trial was tough. It was just a difficult situation, but she did the trial, and at sentencing you just can't decide you're not going to do any more. I mean, there's still, I would imagine there were things that could have been said in a written pre-sentence report on behalf of this defendant that were not said.
That could potentially have been, but I think she made a strategic decision not to do that, and I don't think that there can be any prejudice that can be shown on the record from not making that decision to do that. The trial court was very clear that it based its sentence on multiple factors, including the offender score, which was essentially double of what the standard range would be, that the maximum that had all of the counts been run concurrent, it would have been only 60 months. And this was outside, certainly, of what the legislature contemplated for these kinds of crimes. The fact that the defendant continued to harass the same victim from his prior crimes, the fact that he'd accumulated multiple new victims and that he continued to commit crimes from jail, all of those were the factors that the trial court took into consideration when making its determination. So even if the court were to say defense counsel should have done a little bit more, there's no evidence on the record that there was any prejudice to the defendant. And if there are any more questions, thank you.
Thank you. All right. That concludes this matter. And our